Some Westerners have looked to India as a place for spiritual redemption and enlightenment. But India is also a place of call centers and IT jobs, and despite its dramatic growth, most of the economic changes have yet to trickle down to its poorest sectors. Earlier this year, I spoke with Edward Luce, the author of In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of Modern India. Mr. Luce served as the South Asia Bureau Chief of the Financial Times from 2000 until last year, so he's seen a lot of India's complexities and contradictions firsthand. We thought we might air our conversation again for you today. I started out by asking Mr. Luce why he thinks so many of its visitors have given us a romanticized version of India.
I think that this goes very, very far back into European contact with India. That ever since the late 16th century, when you had Portuguese and English Elizabethan travellers to the Mughal court, it became the sort of principal generator of post Marco Polo Orientalist tales about the East.
But weren't Westerners also? Didn't they also kind of look down on India and what they found there? I guess it was a matter of whether you hung out with the Maharajas or if you saw the way the rest of the people were living.
They looked down and they also spun tall stories. It was a funny mixture. Prior to the high noon of colonialism, though, they didn't look down as much as you would expect. That's really more a Victorian trait. Prior to the Victorian era, there was a great deal of wonder and fascination and exaggeration and what Edward Said would call Orientalism. But it was only really that you got that sort of frosty evangelical disapproving and belittling tone only really starts creeping in with the high noon of Victorianism.
In your book, you used travel down Indian highways to describe the stark disparities among urban and rural Indians. Can you describe the scenes that you saw as you drove down those roads?
Well, yes, the roads I use as kind of a metaphor, the new roads, the new highways, India's first highways, for the schizophrenia of India's economy.
Because it used to be railroads, wasn't it?
Used to be railroads, and it used to be the Grand Trunk Road, which, of course, Kipling popularized in Kim. What you see on those roads is an extraordinary mix between the new economy and all the various car marks and car brands and from the Mercedes down to the Tata Indica. They're jostling for space on the road with herds of goats. You know, these are three lane. These are India's first multi-lane roads. It's called the Golden Quadrilateral. So you see the new consumer brand culture on India's roads and in the wayside gas stations and their air-conditioned cappuccino-serving culture that's sort of... behind them you see the agricultural economy, which really isn't modernizing at anything like the speed of the service economy in India. And you see cows pulling plows and bullocks pulling plows, and you see ancient agricultural methods unchanged.
So is the rich-poor divide the urban-rural divide? Or aren't there a lot of poor people in the big cities as well?
There are a lot of poor people in the big cities, and to some extent the slums are more sort of shockingly poor, but they earn a lot more money in these slums than they do in the villages, and that's why they keep moving in such numbers to the cities. So it's wrong to sort of think that they're involuntarily choosing this poverty. It's a choice. It's an active choice.
Still, things obviously have improved. In 1951, life expectancy in India was 32 years, and that's something that governments had to deal with. The new government, after independence was achieved, had to deal with, and by 2000 it had risen to 64 years, doubled.
It doubled, and you see a quadrupling of the literacy rate, which was only 16% in 1947. I've often said, and others have too, that if China didn't exist, we'd all be talking about the India miracle the whole time. Perhaps not for quite as long, but it's more recent, the India miracle, but it is phenomenal.
Has the miracle been long in coming? What happened after, in the post-colonial period, the early years?
Well, Britain's sort of parting gift, ambivalent gift to India, was really Fabian socialism, which Nehru, India's first post-colonial prime minister, picked up and sort of Indianized. And it really meant that they wanted to build a self-reliant economy that didn't really trade with the world, that emphasized building up heavy industry. There was a Stalinist element to the Nehru's economic plan, and it took 45 years to collapse, but it was always going to, because it just wasn't sustainable.
And so in 1991, finally, India opened itself, its economy, to foreign markets. But is it significant to note that the Prime Minister of India, Manmohan Singh, was the finance minister in 1991?
He was, and of course before 1991 he was planning minister. He's held pretty much every big job Delhi ever has, and he straddled the old era and the new era. He was the man, the architect of India's economic reforms in 1991. India was almost bankrupt. The first Gulf War pushed oil prices up. It couldn't afford to pay the bills. Balance of payments went down to practically zero. India ran to the International Monetary Fund, and in return for international, for IMF bailout, these conditions were attached, and it was to dismantle the old economic model.
Is he the Deng Xiaoping of India?
In a way, he's more impressive than Deng Xiaoping, because he has to operate with a 24-party coalition government, which could collapse at any time. It hasn't, because he's very skilled. But he's not an autocrat. He has to do this by negotiation rather than by fiat. So in a way, I'd give him a higher accolade than Deng Xiaoping.
My guest is Edward Luce. His book, In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of Modern India, published by Doubleday. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Ludwig Lopate. Why strange rise?
Strange is meant in a non-pejorative sense. It's not strange that India is rising. What's strange is how it is rising. It's rising, it's principally led by its service, booming service sector, IT and software principally, in the call centers. That's unusual for a country at this level of development, low level of development. Normally you'd start, as China has been, at the low value-added end of manufacturing.
Although there's a fair amount of that as well, isn't there?
There's a fair amount, but it's actually, and it's increasingly booming too, but it's at the high end of manufacturing. It's quite sophisticated, high value added. And I think the reason for that is India's great strength is the millions of English-speaking graduates, it turns out. It's not, contrary to popular opinion, a cheap labor model, which is essentially the China model and the conventional model. It's a cheap brain power model, which is quite different.
But why isn't it also a cheap labor market? Because a high percentage of the population lives in poverty, doesn't it?
This is the sort of mirror image of China. India's poured money into universities. China poured money into elementary education. India has really lagged behind in terms of mass literacy. And that means that the kind of people that are populating the shop floor in the vast Chinese textile export operations are semi-literate in India and are not really productive enough for that to be economic, however cheap they might be in terms of their wage rates.
What percentage of the population still lives in poverty today?
It's gone down from about 40% a decade ago to about 25% now, or a bit below 25%.
But when you're talking about 25% of over a billion people, you're talking about a lot of people.
You're talking about almost 300 million people.
How much of this has to do with the caste system, which supposedly was dismantled a long time ago?
Yes, on paper in India's constitution, caste discrimination is illegal. But of course, in practice, it's still there. It's still pervasive. I think it's a serious inhibitor to modernization, to the development of civic values, of equality before the law, and of all the other things we associate with modernity. But it is dissolving.
Because there are programs in place to at least help people move up. But untouchables, the stigma is still very powerful, isn't it?
The stigma is still very powerful. One of the things that is helping sort of reduce that stigma is urbanization, because caste is really built around a rural village cottage industry economy.
Where you know everyone, you know that person was born into that family.
Exactly. And they're born into that function as well, that economic function. It doesn't really fit when you move to a city.
Does government corruption promote ethnic and class divisions?
Or the other way around, as sort of a chicken and the egg. The two go hand in hand. Government corruption is a result, to a large extent, of the politics of multi-party coalitions. You basically got to bribe people to remain in your coalition. And the way you bribe them is you give them powers of patronage over the bureaucracy. And so they hand out jobs to people of their own caste and kith and kin. And the state is seen as a sort of extension of your personal fiefdom. That remains a huge problem.
Wouldn't a civil service approach eliminate some of that?
Problem is, civil service is the principal tool of patronage. You know, you expand the civil service to create more jobs. Civil servants are unsackable in India. Even if they're caught with their hand in the till, it is impossible to sack a civil servant. So getting a job in the civil service is a license to print money.
So Prime Minister Singh has not been able to get past that.
He's tried. You can't confront it directly. The coalition would collapse.
Now, India also has, I think, the second largest Muslim population in the world after Indonesia, more than Pakistan. How important is that to the situation in India?
Indians still, to a great extent, see Pakistan as an existential threat to India's existence because Pakistan is supposedly the home for South Asia's Muslims. But there are as many, if not more, Muslims in India.
Are those Indian Muslims pro-Pakistan, or do they see themselves as Indian patriots?
In my view, they are. I've seen very little evidence of pro-Pakistani sentiment. But the Hindu right wing, the Hindu nationalist party in India, the BJP, often likes to paint them in that light. I think it's an inaccurate and incendiary portrayal.
They paint them as a fifth column in India?
Exactly. And that's all they do, you know, when the temperature is high or when there's been a terrorist attack. Local Muslims are scapegoated when almost always they have nothing to do with it.
What sparked the anti-Muslim violence in Gujarat in 2000?
2002,
right.
There was an attack on a train. It's still unclear how it happened or why it happened, where 50 to 60 Hindu activists were burnt to death. And they were coming back from the holy town of Ayodhya, where there is a campaign to build a temple to Ram, one of the main Hindu gods, on the site of a mosque that Hindu activists had demolished. They burnt, whoever it was who burnt this train, and it led to massive riots and reprisals against Muslims, 2,000 of whom died.
To some degree, this is a result of tensions that go back a long time, since the Mughals ruled and often put up mosques on the sites of Hindu holy places, and then the Hindus try to get rid of the mosques and put and return them to being Hindu holy places. It seems to me that a lot of the problem there is that nobody's gotten over things that occurred 300 or 400 years ago.
I would say that's partly right. I wouldn't absolve the British of stoking this division. They divided and ruled, you know, to a degree that really exacerbated these divisions and modernized these divisions, and I think resulted in the unnecessary creation of Pakistan.
Didn't you go to a madrasa in the time between the 9/11 attacks and the invasion of Afghanistan?
I did, the Deoband madrasa, the one that the Taliban take and their inspiration from. The Taliban are often called Deobandis, and I had lots of interesting arguments and discussions with them. Their view was that the Americans would be defeated in Afghanistan, or the Northern Alliance and the Americans would be defeated in Afghanistan because Americans eat chocolate. There was an idea that they were effeminate, too sort of comfortable, living in a materialist American society. There's a very ascetic sort of 7th century Arabian feel to the Deobandi movement that you see in the Taliban.
So it's hard to choose sides in some cases because you see the BJP government being almost at times demagogic in its dealings with the Muslims, and then some Muslims say crazy things like that.
Indeed.
I mean, I don't eat chocolate. That's a matter of preference, but I hope that doesn't mean the Taliban is going to win in Afghanistan.
I had a Snickers bar in my pocket when I was doing this interview, so I quickly sort of hid it. But they need each other. I mean, there are Muslim communalists, as they say in India, communal meaning prejudiced sort of religious political groups, and there are Hindu communalists, and they need each other. They'd stoke each other.
I would assume that that most of the Muslims who are in India choose to be there. They when partition occurred, many people did move. These are people who chose to stay in India, which would suggest, at least to some degree, that they have other reasons for staying in India, which may very well be that they feel that it's their country.
They feel that it's their country. And I think, you know, let's be fair about it. India is a democracy. Pakistan is not. India is growing at very high rates of growth. Pakistan isn't. So if you had to make the choice now, again, you'd probably make the same one.
Can you separate Hindu nationalism from a larger, more general nationalism that is pervasive across class and race lines?
Yeah, the real nationalism of India, with which the Hindu nationalism is sort of locked in battle, is secular nationalism. That was the character of the freedom movement against the British. And how else could you assemble all Indians under one banner unless it were secular? It's so diverse. There is, you know, Hinduism is not a monotheistic religion in the way that Islam is and Christianity is. You can't unite under a one Hindu banner either. It's very, very difficult. So the secular identity of the Congress Party and of the Freedom Movement is Indian nationalism. It is India. I can't imagine an India that isn't secular, because then all the divisions would be what drove events and drove things. That secularism really is the glue of India as a nation state.
My guest is Edward Luce, who's the Washington Bureau Chief for the Financial Times. He was the paper's South Asia Bureau Chief, based in New Delhi between 2001 and 2006. He's written a book called In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of Modern India. It's published by Doubleday. We will continue our conversation after this. We're back with Edward Luce. His book, In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of Modern India, it's published by Doubleday. When did India emerge as the call center mecca of the world?
Really in the late 80s, when Jack Welch of GE went over there for quite different reasons to look at GE production and stumbled across this, by now in retrospect, obvious comparative advantage that India has. And GE started setting up outside of Delhi back office processing and IT maintenance services. And from there, of course, the millennium bug, Y2K bug, was a real windfall for India. And I don't think many Indians believed it was very real, but it generated huge amounts of business. And really, they took off from there on.
Well, who runs these call centers, Indians or Americans and Europeans?
It's a mix. I'd say probably about 50-50. It's probably gone down from about two-thirds Indian, a third foreign, to about 50-50. A lot of people are piling in, really big names. And I think we're only at the very beginning of this phenomenon.
I saw a documentary about one of the call centers, and it was kind of like a mini city. People lived there.
People live there, they get their coffee there, they get credit cards there, they play pool there. There's a certain sort of accessorizing element to being an employee of one of these places.
And in the one that I saw, there was also a proselytizing aspect. People were being converted to Christianity.
That's something that doesn't surprise me. In others, they might be being converted to, you know, some Hindu guru. I mean, these are great places to get that demographic, that snappy, high-spending 20-something demographic.
Now, this is only possible because many Indians are educated in English, but I gather that there are some calls now, some political parties, to only teach the local language, Hindi or whatever the language is.
That's true. That on and off has been a problem. I don't think this is going to be a reversal of India's Anglophonia, if you like, because so many of the private schools that you see developing at the grassroots level in the slums, where you pay 50 rupees a month, are English medium. You know, the sons of rickshaw wallahs want to learn English. It's no longer got a colonial stigma. This is a practical language to learn. And so it's spreading in tandem with political movements to localize education.
Has the brain drain been stopped? There were lots of scientists and software developers who came here from India, and a lot of doctors who also came here.
A lot of doctors. Now we have something called the reverse brain drain, which in some cases means moving back to India, but in other cases means putting your money back, where you've earned your money in Silicon Valley. You set up a startup in Bangalore. That there's a lot of money coming from Indians based on the West Coast in Northern California, going back to India. And so there's a human and a capital reverse sort of flow going on there.
How has the marketing industry transformed the urban landscape since 1991?
The urban landscape has really been transformed by the liberalization of the economy, and the marketing industry sort of reflects that. The billboards, the TV ads, the cell phone ads that you received in text form, there's a sort of multiplicity of consumer advertising mediums now, and India excels at all of them.
Have certain political parties become more successful because of these changes? Is there a middle class political party?
Well, you know, the BJP is really the middle class party of India, the urban middle class party of India.
I would have thought, because it plays on ancient fears, that it probably would have been the party of, forgive me for using the word, lower classes.
No, not at all. It's really upper caste Hindus who fear the dissolution of their control over India because of the rise of the lower castes. And, of course, the lower castes weren't allowed traditionally into the temples. The new India, everybody enters the temple, which is on television. Hinduism has moved into new mediums. So the Hindu nationalists are principally upper caste and urban middle class.
Often when a country starts going through these changes, traditions become a big issue. Is that a problem in India? Are there people who want to hold on to the traditions?
Yes, although, you know, fundamentalism is a very modern phenomenon. It's sort of tradition made aware of itself and defensive. So it's by definition a modern thing, fundamentalism. And the traditions they're defending are often invented traditions for contemporary political reasons.
And then I gather if people write books along those lines, sometimes their lives are threatened because people don't want to believe that these traditions, which they consider to be intrinsic to the Indian experience, are really only 200 or 300 years old.
Well, precisely. Best example I can think of, in fact, is a guy called Dien Jha, an Indian historian who wrote a book called The Myth of India's Holy Cow. And he produced a lot of evidence to show that there was beef eating amongst Hindus in the first millennium AD. The book was banned. He very nearly got killed. His house got attacked. He was threatened with being thrown out of his job at the university. I bought the book in London. But he stuck to his guns. And I think the book sort of has a sort of Samizdat life in India. But his scholarship was impeccable. There was beef eating. And the anti-beef eating movement was really set up to rally Hindus against Muslims who were beef eaters and who were therefore not us. And it was a sort of very emotive rallying cry that took off in the 19th century.
The movie Water, which is up for an Academy Award here, was originally banned in India, and I understand now it's finally being released. That's the story about how widows, even widows who were pre-adolescent, were forced to live the rest of their lives in convents or the equivalent, and sometimes support themselves through prostitution. Are things loosening up?
Things are loosening up. I mean, I remember why that was banned. And if you see the film, it's so obviously shot in Sri Lanka. It's a beautiful film, but the colors are all wrong. It's supposedly in a northern Indian temple town. And the colors are far too green and luxuriant and tropical. But sorry, I forgot your question.
Are things loosening up that the censorship now has been eased, at least in that case, or is this a case-by-case?
No, it's case-by-case, and anything which offends any religious community will be banned. So Salman Rushdie's two novels that were banned, first was, of course, Satanic Verses, because it offended the Muslim community. Then The Moor's Last Sigh, because it lampoons and caricatures the Hindu nationalist community. So, you know, there's a level playing field in terms of censorship. There's still censorship.
My guess is Edward Luce. His book, In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of Modern India, is published by Doubleday. We talked earlier about India and China being seen as these two growing economies. What relations have often been tense between the two countries? Have they eased?
They've eased very significantly. There was a very nasty border war in 1962 that China won. China occupied a large sort of slice of India on their Himalayan, their joint Himalayan border. And it really took 25 to 30 years for those very tense relations to thaw. Now they're trading with each other on a scale that was unimaginable even 4 or 5 years ago. And trade is really beginning to drive the relationship. And on the other side of things, Pakistan's support for China's support for Pakistan has tapered off. It's a far more moderate, it's a far more stable relationship, which is a good thing.
But won't they eventually be competing for foreign dollars and for foreign energy sources, because the two of them are going to need more and more petroleum to fuel their growing industries?
Well, some people call it the new great game, and China and India's search for very mercantilist search to get oil at source rather than to buy it from the markets in some of the most unsavory regions of the world, you know, Sudan, parts of Central Asia, Angola, Burma, of course, Myanmar. They're competing, but they're also cooperating. They both need this fuel. They both need the gas that they have contracts to buy from Iran, for example, which is causing some friction between Washington and Delhi. But they both have the same desire, and they don't mind upsetting America and going to pariah states to get it.
Have they stopped building these large infrastructure projects like huge dams?
Dams are out of fashion. There's been sort of the displacement of people, the fact that they didn't receive compensation, the fact that these were the types who did involuntarily end up in the slums, those who were displaced by dams. They're out of fashion. Nuclear, much like anywhere else, civil nuclear power plants are coming into fashion. And so is gas, gas from Iran.
Of course, when we talk about nuclear, we're also talking about the fact that India has an atomic bomb, as does Pakistan. What about the government's nuclear deal with the United States last year, which was led by the Congress Party? Has India's nuclear program influenced its sense of nationalism, and how has it affected its relations with other countries?
I think it's, you asked about China, the question before. It's made China treat India differently. China
with more respect?
With more respect. Because, of course, the Pakistan nuclear deterrent is really an extension of the Chinese one. And the technology was transferred to Pakistan from China. So when India developed its nuclear weapons in relation to Pakistan, it was more properly in relation to China. China has a much larger nuclear arsenal. China is an official nuclear power. But it has treated India with more respect and said so publicly. India said we'd like a mutual non-targeting agreement. They said it before they tested nuclear weapons in 1998. And China said, what's the point in having a non-targeting agreement with a non-nuclear power? After 1998, they've talked Turkey with them. It has caused people to sit up and treat India with respect.
The Chinese boom is being fueled by people coming off the farms and moving into the big cities. What about India? What are the consequences of greater economic security for the upper and middle classes without regard to rural India?
I think this is one of the huge problems India is yet to confront, which I would trace back to Gandhi's influence, mostly overwhelmingly wonderfully positive influence, happened to be negative in how India approached urbanization and economic development. It was a very romantic place for the village in Gandhi's view of the world. And that has meant that India hasn't embraced urbanization in the way that it should have. And that the urban experience for most people who come into the cities is much less sanitary and planned than it ought to be. Gandhi's had a phrase that it costs a lot to keep me in poverty, or somebody said that about him. It costs a lot to keep Gandhi in poverty. And as I say in the book, that meter is still running.
Isn't there a growing movement among the rural poor?
There is, but there really is no such an abstract term, rural poor. There are lots of different rural poors, and it really depends on what language you speak, what caste you belong to, what region you're in, and what religion you follow. There's no such thing as national movements.
Except the Congress Party functioned that way, didn't it?
But it's now got down. It started with 50% of the vote or thereabouts after independence. It's now down to about 25% of the vote. You have a national Hindu nationalist movement. You have lots of lower caste movements. So an untouchable in one state might be a different subcaste untouchable in another and not feel anything in common with an untouchable, therefore, in a different part of India. They tend to organize separately in different states into different parties.
And that's because, really, India could be broken up into a whole bunch of different countries. There are so many different languages. There are different traditions. Punjabis, in some cases, have more in common with the Punjabis in Pakistan than they do with people in other parts of India, and the same is true with Bengalis, who often have more in common with the people in Bangladesh than they do with other people in India.
That's true, which is why secularism is the glue of India. It was fashionable after independence to predict India would break up. It wouldn't survive as a nation state or as a democracy. That was the sort of default conventional wisdom. But I think because of the surprising rootedness of democracy in India, and because of the durability of its secular constitution, India not only survived, but it will continue to.
Will it become a superpower?
Not in the sense America is now. It'll become a great power in the way we used those terms in that term in the 19th century.
On the cover of Edward Luce's book, we see a man in an orange turban with a cell phone to his ear, and behind him, a camel. The book is called In Spite of the Gods, The Strange Rise of Modern India. It is published by Doubleday. And it has been my great pleasure to talk with Edward Luce today. Thank you so much for being here.
Many thanks for having me.
On Monday's show, why Abraham Lincoln is still a controversial figure in some parts of the country, and a documentary takes us into Israeli detention centers where Palestinian politicians and would-be suicide bombers are being held. Plus, Simon Sharma examines the turning points in the lives of eight great artists in his new PBS series, Power of Art. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. Debbie Daughtry was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. Have a great weekend. See you on Monday.